Burdett smiled, but it looked purely mechanical. "I was born in Georgia," said Doug. "I know." They had reached the door to Doug's quarters, which was doubling as his office now that Jenny Anson occupied the director's post. Opening it, Doug ushered Gordette in with a gesture. "The others'll be here in a few minutes." The smart walls were all blank as they stepped in. Gordette started to sit on the couch by the door, but Doug pointed to the sling chair next to his writing desk. As he went to the desk and dropped into a swivel chair, Doug said, "We can use the few minutes to get to know each other." Gordette nodded tightly. Doug looked into his deep brown eyes and saw that Gordette would be a tough opponent in a poker game. He gave away nothing. "You were in the army?" Doug prompted. "Special forces." "How long?" "I did a 4-year hitch." "Why did you leave?" "Got a better offer." Doug tapped on his keyboard and Gordette's personnel file came up on the wall screen to his left. "What kind of a company is Falcon Electronics?" "Small," said Gordette. "They did customized electro-optical rigs, stuff like that." "You were with them almost 9 years?" "Right." "And then you got a job with Masterson Corporation and came to Moonbase?" "Right." Leaning back in his chair, Doug asked, "How do you like it here?" Gordette thought for a moment. "Not bad. Most of the people here are smart, civilized."
"Civilized?"
"There's not much of a color problem here. Not like back in the States." Doug felt shocked.
"You had race problems?"
Gordette smiled again, but this time it dripped acid. "There's no black man on earth doesn't have race problems."
"I'm part black," Doug said.
"My father,
I know all about it.
But your skin is white enough, and you got enough money, so it doesn't matter to you." Doug felt as if you were battering against a solid steel barrier. Not that Gordette seemed hostile. He simply offered nothing. It was like talking to an automaton. And yet there was something going on behind those unwavering eyes. The man wasn't stupid, Doug judged. "He's just sitting there looking at me, as if he's studying me." Lev Brudenoy stuck his head through Doug's open door and broke the tightening silence. Moments later, Jenny Anson, Professor Zimmerman, and Chris Cardenas joined the conference. As they carefully, meticulously went over every inch of Moonbase's layout, equipment, and supplies, Doug watched Gordette. The man said nothing, but seemed entirely focused on their discussion. He listened intently, hands clasped in front of his face as if in prayer. Every now and then, though, Doug caught him looking directly at him. Gordette never looked away. He simply stared at Doug, face utterly impassive, eyes boring into Doug as if he were taking X-ray photographs.
"So we can button up and wait for him to run out of air," Anson said, waving a hand at the schematic diagram of the base that filled one whole wall of Doug's office.
"Suppose they blow out the main airlock," Brudenoy asked. "What then?" Anson's normally perky expression paled slightly.
"Why would they do that?"
"They want to take over the base," Brudenoy replied.
"Yeah, but they wouldn't want to kill us. Not if we're just sitting tight inside."
"Blowing the main airlock wouldn't necessarily kill us, would it?" Cardenas asked.
"No,"
said Anson.
"It'd just open up the garage.
All the tunnels would still be sealed off."
"Corridors," Doug corrected.
"Whatever."
"Still," Brudenoy said, "if they blast out the main airlock, that would surely mean that they are prepared to blow their way through any of the other airlocks and hatches in the base."
"It would mean they're ready to kill us," Doug agreed.
Zimmerman, sitting alone on the couch by the door, pointed out,
"If they blast open the main airlock, we would have to surrender. There would be no other option."
"Not unless we can breathe vacuum," Anson admitted.
Doug turned to Gordette, and again the man was staring at him.
"What do you think, Bam? What does your military experience tell you?"
Without the slightest hesitation, Gordette replied, "The peacekeepers are trained to accomplish their mission with as little bloodshed as possible. They won't blow any airlocks. Not at first, anyway."
"You mean we could sit inside and wait them out?" Anson asked.
Gordette shook his head.
"What would you do," Doug asked, "if you were heading up this peacekeeper mission?"
Getting slowly to his feet, Gordette walked to the wall map and pointed to the thin lines that represented the buried power cables that led from the solar farms into the base. I cut your electrical power lines. Here, here, and here.
The solar farms, murmured Brudnoy.
Without electricity, this base goes down the tubes. Gordette made a diving motion with one hand.
We have the backup nuclear system, Anson said.
They know that, Gordette replied flatly. They've got as good a map of this base as you do.
Doug said, so they'll cut the line from the nuke, too.
Gordette nodded.
Kaput, said Zimmerman.
How long can we last without electricity?
30 seconds, perhaps.
We have emergency batteries, fuel cells, said Anson.
So? How much time do they give us?
A few hours.
The peacekeepers will have enough air to wait for us to surrender, no?
Yes.
From his chair in front of Doug's desk, Brudnoy looked up at Gordette with gloom in his pouchy eyes.
Is there anything we can do? Anything at all?
Gordette seemed to think about it for a moment. There's a maneuver that we use in martial arts when your opponent points a gun at you.
What is it?
Gordette slowly raised his arms over his head in the universal sign of surrender. The room fell into a dismal silence. Doug looked at them. They seemed defeated already.
What we've learned, he said in as firm a voice as he could, is that we've got to keep the peacekeepers from cutting our power lines.
How? Brudnoy asked.
Doug pointed toward Zimmerman. We need something to defend those power lines.
Something, Zimmerman growled. What?
That's what you've got to figure out, Professor, and you've got less than 4 days to do it.
Touchdown minus 63 hours, 29 minutes. Joanna Masterson Stavanger was not accustomed to being snubbed, not even by the world's most powerful politicians. But Faure refused to speak to her. At first, the UN simply did not acknowledge her calls. The wall screen in her quarters showed nothing but electronic hash. The comtech who was monitoring her transmission said flatly, "They're not answering." She reached the Masterson Corporation offices in New York and tried to pipe a call to Faure through them. After nearly 24 hours of delays and evasions, one of the UN flunkies blandly told her that the Secretary General was unavailable. Huffing with impatient anger, Joanna called Masterson Corporate Headquarters in Savannah on a direct laser link.
"I want to speak with the chairman of the board," she told a young man whose face appeared on her wall screen.
"Mr. Rashid isn't here, Mrs. Brudnoy. He's in..." Joanna did not wait for the sentence to end.
"Find him, wherever he is. I need to talk to him immediately."
It took almost 3 seconds for her words to reach Rashid's aide and his startled expression to show on her screen.
"Get him!" she snapped.
Nearly half an hour later, Ibrahim al-Rashid's face finally appeared on the wall screen. He had been handsome once, but now his romantic good looks were sinking into softness. His closely clipped beard was streaked with gray, as was his tightly curled hair. He had a look of decadence about him, Joanna thought. She knew that Rashid did not drink. He was a faithful Muslim in that regard. But there were drugs. And women, many of them. And the responsibilities that came inescapably with great power.
"Greetings and felicitations, most illustrious one," he said, his voice reedy but melodious. "How are you enjoying your visit to the moon?"
"I need to talk to Faure," Joanna said, unwilling to engage in the usual banter.
3 seconds later, Rashid's brows rose slightly.
"I very much doubt that the Secretary General would be willing to speak with you at this point in time."
"Make it happen, Omar," Joanna snapped.
If her use of his old nickname upset him, Rashid showed no trace of it. He merely smiled patiently and replied,
"And how do I do that, Joanna? Rub a magic lamp?"
Holding on to her swooping temper, Joanna replied,
"You get that little Kay Becker on the phone and tell him that I'm going to announce to the news media that he has no intention of shutting down Moonbase. He's going to continue using our nanomachines for his own profit."
Rashid seemed more sobered than surprised when her words reached him.
"Your son's declaration of Moonbase's independence has not been carried by the media," he said slowly. "There is a blackout on news about Moonbase.